Afternoon. This is Carl Malamud for the Internet Multicasting Service. Today is Friday, February 4th. We're multicasting live from our studios in the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. Today's guest is Richard Gephardt. Gephardt is the majority leader of the U.S. Congress. He'll be speaking today on the question of health care. While we're waiting for the luncheon to begin, we're going to turn the microphone over to our house band, Tungsten Macaque. This is the Internet Multicasting Service, Flame of the Internet.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Gil Klein. I'm president of the club, and I'm a national correspondent with Media General newspapers, writing for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, the Tampa Tribune, and the Winston-Salem Journal. I'd like to welcome all you club members and your guests in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching this on C-SPAN, or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind our members of some upcoming events. On Tuesday, February 8th, Randall Terry, founder of Operation Rescue, the anti-abortion group, will present a speech entitled, "The Republican Party, Enemy of a Christian Nation." I don't know who wrote that speech, but I see some fingerprints. On Tuesday, February 15th, Energy Secretary Hazel O'Leary will present a speech entitled, "The Cold War is Over, We Want Your Trust, and We'll Work to Earn It." And on Tuesday, March 1st, Carol Bellamy, the former Peace Corps volunteer, the first former Peace Corps volunteer to return as director of the Peace Corps. We'll talk about the Peace Corps at 30-something, where we are, what we've learned. Transcripts and audio and video tapes of this luncheon are available by calling 1-800-500-9911. If you have any questions for our speaker, and I certainly trust that you will, please write them down on the cards provided for you at the tables and pass them up to me, and I will ask as many as time allows. I'd now like to introduce our head table guest and ask them to please stand briefly when their names are called. Please withhold your applause until all the names are read. From your right, Sue Kirchhoff of Reuters, Rick Dunham of Business Week, Andy Miller of the Kansas City Star, Lynn Wagner of the Modern Healthcare Magazine, Carl Lubsdorf, Dallas Morning News Bureau Chief, Charlotte Grimes of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Congressman Henry Waxman, Democrat of California. Skipping over our speaker for a second, we have Christy Wise, freelance journalist and chairwoman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. Congressman Sander Levin, Democrat of Michigan. Joan Lowy, Scripps Howard News Service, and member of the Speakers Committee, member of the National Press Club Speakers Committee, who organized today's luncheon. David Hess of Knight Ridder Newspapers and a past president of the club. Marianne Means, columnist with Hearst Newspapers and vice chairman of the National Press Foundation. Mark August, international columnist for the Tampa Tribune. And finally, last but certainly not least, John Mashick of the Boston Globe. I'd also like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Pat Thornsberry, and Melanie Abdow-Dermott, and Jeff Tarbell for organizing today's luncheon. Our speaker today is Representative Richard Gephardt, Democrat of Missouri, who is the majority leader in the House of Representatives. Mr. Gephardt comes to us when Congress is debating more significant issues than at any time, probably, since Lyndon Johnson's Great Society program. Between now and October, it will be wrestling with health care reform, welfare reform, and crime legislation. Throw in on top of that such side issues as campaign finance reform, clean water bill, Superfund program. And this could remember either as an historic Congress or the world's largest and most public nervous breakdown. Into this fray comes Mr. Gephardt, who was described by David Rogers in the Wall Street Journal last June as one of the most durable figures of government. From Russian aid to health reform to the deficit, no one in Congress is more central to the administration's agenda, Mr. Rogers wrote. The Wall Street Journal often is not so kind, so that's quite great praise indeed. And as Mr. Gephardt showed in the fight over the North American Free Trade Agreement, he can be a formidable foe, even when fighting a bill backed by a Democratic president and the Republican establishment. Dick Gephardt's rise to such influence has been a combination of hard work and good fortune. He who was, and as you can see, still is, a clean-cut all-American boy from the south side of St. Louis, the son of a milkman and a legal secretary. In college, he was president of his fraternity and the student body. He was a young activist on the St. Louis Board of Aldermen, a moderate Democrat when he reached Congress in 1977. He rose to leadership ranks through his hard work in combating President Reagan's agenda. And he was one of the founders of the Democratic Leadership Council, which sought to move his party more towards the mainstream. And there are political scientists today who argue that Mr. Gephardt might have made it to the Oval Office himself in 1988. If only he had had Michael Dukakis's eyebrows. Mr. Gephardt is known as a partisan fighter, and I've just taken a quick look at his remarks here, and I can tell you that, paraphrase a famous actress, fasten your seatbelt, boys, this is going to be a bumpy ride today. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in a warm press club welcome for House Majority Leader Richard Gephardt.
Hey. Thank you very much for that kind introduction. I deeply appreciate it. I hope my eyebrows are sufficiently bright today so that everyone can see me. And I want to thank my colleagues Sandy Levin and Henry Waxman, who know more about the subject I'm going to talk about today than I do. So I'm happy to have them here with me to answer the tough questions when they come. I'm here today to talk about the health of our nation. I'm here to talk about the health care that shapes our lives and our livelihoods. And I'm here to talk about our courage and our conscience as a nation and as a people. The fact is, there are a whole lot of Americans who know our health care system is in crisis. And we have the ability and the obligation to do something about it. In this most powerful nation in the world, how can we tell a hard-working young couple trying to make a better life for their children that if they don't have wealth, they can't have health? That if they can't write big enough checks, they can't give their children checkups? In the nation that discovered the polio vaccine and pioneered prenatal care and moves closer to curing AIDS and cancer each and every day, how can we tell our people that we'd like to do something about the health care crisis that wastes billions of dollars and endangers millions of lives, but it's just too difficult, too complex, too painful for the politicians and the parochial interests? Of course, it is difficult. It is complex. And it won't come without a fight. No one knows better than I do that it will be a tough battle to win those votes in Congress, to out-organize the lobbyists, to outsmart the apologists of the status quo, to drown out the chorus that will do almost anything to defeat the other side's policies, even if it means holding back a people's progress. But there comes a time in the life of our nation when we all must try to rise above the partisanship, when we must move forward in the service of a higher purpose. And this is that time. And national health care, guaranteed, affordable coverage for every single American, is our purpose and our crusade. It is the right thing to do. It's what the people of America demand and deserve. But there is a powerful, organized opposition that doesn't understand, or pretends it doesn't understand, the human pain and the moral imperative. They seem to think that when it comes to health care, some should be more equal than others. They seem to think it's fine to heed the needs of the special interests, but to hide from the pleas of the public interest. Let me tell you, if that's what they think, then they've got another thing coming. The American people want health care that they can afford. They want guaranteed health care. They want this Congress to stand up to the lobbyists and paper pushers. And they know the difference between a government that stands up for them and a government that stands in their way. That's why the fight for guaranteed, affordable health care coverage is so important to me. Because ultimately, you know, this is not about policies and programs and ideas. It's about people. We all know there are plenty of powerful, narrow interests ready to stand together in unholy matrimony to protect their privilege and their profit. But who will stand up for the people's interest? Who will stand up for those who live in fear of a serious illness because it would break their bank account? Who will stand up for those who suffer helplessly through sickness and disease because they can't afford a doctor and haven't reached the brink of catastrophe that finally puts them into an emergency room? Who will say to the hardworking taxpaying Americans, health care is your right, and if you live up to your part of the bargain, we won't leave you out in the cold? Who will say to Americans' families, you can have the freedom to choose your own doctor because we'll make sure you can afford your own doctor? Who will say to America's entrepreneurs, you can leave your job and start your own business, build your dreams, and you still can have health insurance? Sadly, we know what the Republican Party will say. We hear it now every day. And we've heard it again and again in every decade. Every time our government tries to improve people's lives, every time we try to lift people up, they say it's socialism. It's big government. It's tax and spend. Let's recall today the Republican rhetoric during the great debate of Social Security in 1935. Republican Congressman John Tabor said Social Security was insidiously designed to prevent business recovery, and he said to enslave workers. Republican Congressman Daniel Reed said it was the lash of the dictator. Social Security. When Democrats pressed the case for Medicare in 1965, Republican Congressman James Utt said it was socialized medicine. Republican Congressman Joel Broyhill said it would impair the quality of health care, retard the advancement of medicine, and displace private health insurance. Medicare. And an ambitious Republican actor named Ronald Reagan said that if Medicare passed, and I quote, we'd spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it was once like in America where men were free. Let me tell you, a lot of us feel the same way about the Reagan presidency. And now that the Democratic Party is trying to fix the crushing health care crisis, we're hearing the same rehashed, time-worn, discredited rhetoric. Newt Gingrich says that guaranteed coverage is, I quote, socialism, now or later, and a dictatorship on health care. That's what he said. Dictatorship. Just a few years ago, Bob Dole was talking in somber tones about the health care crisis confronting the nation. Now he says there's no crisis. There's a real pattern of denial going on here. 2 years ago, the Republicans said there was no recession. Now they say there's no health care crisis. You know, they just don't get it. 2 years from now, they'll probably say there was never an earthquake in California. Thankfully, all the rusted republicanism, all those sound bites paid for by the powerful special interests, all of it has failed to block our progress. At the end of the day, more than half of all Republicans voted for Medicare. Almost 8 of 10 Republicans voted for Social Security. And yes, we passed those landmark reforms despite the protests and the press releases and the pressure tactics from the big business lobbies. I hope and expect that the same will happen on health care, and if it does, I'll be the first to reach out my hand. But the Republicans have to reach out their hands too, and they still have a long way to go. When you listen to some of their pronouncements on the issue, you'd think the only person expected to budge an inch is the President of the United States. And the question is, when do we all move past all of the rhetoric? When do we move past the posturing and the barrage of slick Madison Avenue ads and start talking about the hard facts on health care? The special interest groups have already spent more than $14 million on ads to defeat guaranteed health care. $14 million, and it's only February. It's only the beginning. Think about how many children could be immunized for that kind of money. Think about how many families could have decent health care for that amount of money and the money that will be spent. And now the House Republicans, according to the morning papers, have even started lobbying the lobbyists. Yesterday, the United States Chamber of Commerce was ready to tell the truth, that a lot of the president's proposal makes sense for American business. But they changed their position after, apparently, the Republicans twisted their arms and they twisted the facts in the process. When the real debate begins, when the real facts are laid on the table, all Americans will see that guaranteed affordable health care is not a luxury, it's a necessity. It won't waste money, it will save money. By turning the most expensive, most bureaucratic, most chaotic health care system in the world into a system that cares for all of its people and pays for all its people when they need it the most and when it costs us the least. And it won't be the birth of a large new bureaucracy. Listen to this. In the state of Hawaii, the only state in the union to guarantee coverage, and they did it over 20 years ago, the only state to meet the people's health care needs before they become full-blown crises. Do you know how many people it takes to administer their system of private employer-based health coverage? Two. That's right. Just two people. Although the governor of Hawaii tells me they work very, very hard every day. You see, guaranteed coverage works. It works. It's not just the morally responsible thing to do. It's the sensible thing to do. So on behalf of the Democrats and the United States Congress, I make this solemn pledge. We'll stand up and fight for America's working families. We'll make their fight for decent, affordable health care our fight. And together we'll put a decent, affordable health care bill on President Clinton's desk this year. This year. Guaranteed coverage is not a particularly new idea. It happens in nations all over this world. And it's been proposed in our own country many, many times. But after 12 years of an executive branch that passed the buck until there were almost no bucks left, many had given up on health care. Many had grown used to the gridlock, the litany of executive excuses that were short on detail and long on despair. But you know, that all changed last year, when President Clinton stood before both houses of Congress and presented his proposal for national health care security. He offered a real solution to a system that is worse than wrong. It's a system that's driving this country into economic disaster. Health care costs are soaring past the rate of inflation and have been for 20 years in this country. Since 1978, when I began speaking about health care, the average cost of a family policy has skyrocketed from $800 a year to more than $5,000 a year. And while total spending on health care was about $2,500 per family in 1980, by 1993 it jumped to more than $7,700, and unless we do something to stop it, by the year 2000, it'll be more than $14,000 a year for a single family. Think today what that means to a middle-class family. Think what it means to a family that's already struggling to get ahead, to pay a mortgage, to put kids through college. You know what it means. It means that at the rate we're going, they're going to just give up health care. They're not going to have any other choice. And while a lot of factors are involved, there are two main reasons that health care costs are out of control. First of all, we may not have guaranteed coverage, but we do have guaranteed treatment. 24 million Americans lose their insurance and their access to decent, consistent primary care each year. But when a crisis hits and they show up at an emergency room, as they do, we don't turn them away, even if they can't pay. We do what a compassionate and sensible society must do. But we also pay. We pay millions to treat sickness and disease that could have been prevented or treated earlier for pennies. A woman has a mastectomy that could have been prevented through earlier detection of breast cancer. She pays the human price, we pay the financial price. A child is debilitated by diabetes that could have been caught early and treated for a fraction of the cost and a fraction of the pain. The child pays the human price, all of us pay the financial one. A wage-earning, hard-working man gets cancer, loses his insurance, spends the final weeks of his life in expensive, intensive care. That man pays the human price. We all pay the financial price. The head of a major insurance company here told me the other day that uncompensated care accounted for about half of last year's price increases. That's not health care. It's stealth care. It's a hidden tax that makes our system more expensive, less efficient, less effective. And over again, there is a terrible human price. Unless we have health care that is always there, we will never have health care that's always fair. That hidden tax will keep growing. It'll keep devastating family budgets. It'll keep lowering business bottom lines. It'll keep poisoning our progress and our productivity. So you see, despite the Republican rhetoric, guaranteed health care is not a barrier to lowering costs. It's the only way we can get that job done. The only way. Now, there's another reason that the current system of health care is draining our bank accounts. And it really is about the way we pay for health care today. On a no-holds-barred, fee-for-service basis, we basically say to the nation's doctors and hospitals and pharmaceutical companies, go ahead, charge us whatever you want. We'll pick up the tab for the paperwork and the profiteering and the unnecessary procedure. Just go ahead, do whatever you want. So there's no real incentive for hospitals or doctors to rein in their costs, no real incentive for insurers to shred the red tape, to trim the bloated bills that make our premiums just absolutely go through the roof. And when costs go through the roof, when we pay more and more for the same coverage that we had last year, there's nothing we can do about it. There's nothing except buy our fewer benefits or lose our coverage altogether. And that, of course, is happening to too many hardworking families, and then we pay for their health care anyway. You know, this cost spiral is kind of, to me, like a runaway train. There's so much money involved. There's so many entrenched interests at stake. It just keeps picking up momentum and steam and plowing down everything in its path. If we wait any longer, there's not going to be any way to finally stop it. I think I speak for most Americans when I say it is time to put on the brakes. It's time for real competition, time for real cost containment. And it's time for our government to step in and make a difference, not by socializing health care, because our private system is the best health care system in the world, bar none, but by keeping what works and fixing what doesn't, by making health care work for people instead of the paper pushers. Now, some say that the real problem is that we just don't have the guts to face up to what is the real problem. We're afraid to talk about what's really involved here. We're afraid to talk about rationing health care, to draw the line on who receives what services. But the whole point is we don't want government making those decisions. If we can simply bring real economic forces into the system, doctors and families together will start making real and rational decisions based on what's right for them together. Some say that the private sector will, you know, control all of this alone. We don't have to worry about any of this. That given a chance, private sector will voluntarily take care of all this. Just give them a chance. But the healthcare industry had its chance. Some of you may remember, probably not many in the room, but some may remember Jimmy Carter, who tried to pass price controls back in the late 1970s. I was new to Congress, but I spoke out. And I crafted a bill. You may remember it. It was called the Gephardt Amendment. Henry remembers it well. And it said we could do this voluntarily. Let's give the industry a chance without price controls. I did that because I believed that when the industry said they could hold down the costs and clean up their own house, that they would do that, or that they should be given a chance to do that. And so I understand why some people take that position today. The Gephardt Amendment prevailed. But the fact is, 15 years later, I was wrong. 15 years later, costs have exploded. They haven't gone up. They've exploded. Bureaucracy is out of control. And we can't be fooled by the fact that this year, when we're on the brink of real reform, inflation of health care costs should go down. Every time we've had a shot at real reform, every time the special interests are threatened, they band together and they show us their best behavior. And every time they succeed at killing reform, they go right back to their old habits and the numbers shoot right back up. We've seen it before and we should not let it fool us again. So the next time the Republicans tell you we can't afford guaranteed coverage, ask them how we cannot afford to have it. The next time they tell you that millions of Americans can live without health insurance, ask them how they'd like to live, relying on emergency rooms for family care. And the next time they tell you there's no health care crisis in America, ask them what country they are living in. This year, we have a real opportunity for change, a real opportunity to move this country forward together. Bill Clinton has proposed the most comprehensive health care reform system in the history of this country. The president's proposal is not perfect, but it's a very, very important start and beginning of this discussion. And it achieves the basics of real reform. It works for insured families because it ensures that affordable coverage can never be taken away. It guarantees private insurance for every American because that's the only way the system can work, if everybody's involved paying what they can instead of paying what other people cannot. It brings competition into the system and limits premium increases. Because if doctors and providers and insurers have no incentive to keep costs under control, health care will bring us into bankruptcy. It's comprehensive. Because decades of toying and tinkering around the edges have only made the system more confusing, more confounding, and more chaotic. And it preserves the greatest strength of our health care system. Our outstanding network of doctors and nurses and health professionals trained in the healing arts and deeply dedicated to the people that they serve every day. I can guarantee you that that's the one part of the system that will not change. Our system will remain private. Americans will still be able to choose their doctor and the health plan that meets their needs. I support the President's proposal, and I believe that in the coming months, as the debate continues, it will grow even stronger than it is today. But it won't come without a little discomfort. You can't grow without growing pains. To make guaranteed health care happen, we've got to pitch in, to look beyond the party labels, and we've got to work together for the common good. And health care is one issue we cannot afford to delay any longer. I know from experience that it can mean the difference between life and death. More than two decades ago, when I was a local lawyer in St. Louis, my two-year-old son, Matt, was diagnosed with cancer. And the doctors told us when we had finally made that diagnosis that he probably wouldn't make it. And I remember standing in the hall at Children's Hospital as if it were yesterday, and the doctors telling my wife, Jean, and me that he didn't have much chance at all. My law firm where I worked had a health plan. And until then, we hadn't really thought much about it, frankly. Hadn't been sick. No one had been sick. But we knew that Matt's only chance of pulling through depended on new and experimental drugs and therapies, the kind of therapies that we never could have afforded on our own. And that insurance plan gave Matt, our son, a real shot at health and life. We were very, very lucky. Matt not only pulled through, he graduated from Duke University last year. And he's one of the greatest gifts that Jane and I could ever have. But some of us are not so lucky. I'll never forget the nights that I spent sitting at his bedside as he got chemotherapy, talking to the parents of his roommates. One was a young child also with a severe cancer, but a family who couldn't afford health insurance. Every time they brought their youngster to the hospital for a chemotherapy treatment, they had to scrape together about $300 borrowed from friends and family and neighbors and sometimes from people they didn't even know. It was bad enough that they had to live with the pain of their child's illness. But at the same time, they had to live with the indignity, the injustice of having to borrow and beg just to give him decent, life-giving care. And as long as I live, I will never forget the words that father spoke to me after one long and painful night we spent together at the hospital. He said, "I know my son's sickness may be stronger than he is, and I know that he's probably going to die. And I can figure out how to live with that. But what I can't live with is the thought that he might die not because of the disease God gave him, but because of the dollars that I could not give him." And every night as I sat at my son's side, I prayed for them. And I thought to myself, it should not be this way. It doesn't have to be this way. No American deserves that kind of indignity and pain. And we as Americans must ensure that no American endures it. We've got to affirm the basic principle of human decency, that our health should never be determined by our wealth. We've got to fight for the working families who are being priced out of good health. And we've got to pass the guaranteed health plan that this economy needs and our people demand. We'll do it for ourselves and we'll do it for our children. We'll do it for those who are sick today and those who will be struck by sickness and disaster tomorrow. We'll do it for the goals upon which this nation was founded: justice, equality, opportunity for all. And we'll do it because it is right for the country that we love and for the commitment that we share. Thank you very much.
We have a lot of very good questions coming in here, so let's get right to them. A lot of them started out this way. This is a fighting speech. Have Democrats decided to draw a partisan line in the sand? How can you get cooperation that way, bipartisan cooperation that way, and why focus attacks on Republicans when Clinton doesn't have enough Democratic support to pass this bill right now?
I guess I tried to give a speech today that I thought was not so much partisan, but maybe a call to arms. I think we need everybody in this country to pass this bill. I do not have an illusion that we will all agree at the end of the day that the bill that's in front of us should be passed. But to do something big and important and that requires this much change really does take an extraordinary national effort. And it will take Democrats primarily, because we have always been the party that has stood for social progress and moves and changes of this kind. Social Security would not be in our land if it were not for the Democratic Party. Medicare would not be in our land if it were not for the Democratic Party. But as I tried to say today, it took not only a lot of Democrats, but there were a lot of Republicans who were willing to vote for it as well. And I want, at the end of the day, for that to be the case with this bill. In order to do that, we really do have to stop saying this plan is bad because of this and that, and get down to a hard discussion, as I started to try to do today. We need to talk about what it is that has to be in this. What are the positive things that we've got to try to accomplish? If we can agree on what we're trying to do, and the President in his speech both last year and this year tried to set out what is important to try to do, then we together can figure out, I think, at the end of the day, how to do it. And that's what it's going to take to get this done. We will not pass a Democratic bill. We will not pass a Republican bill. We will pass a consensus bill that has the support and the confidence of the vast majority of the American people. And then, when it's finished, it will work in reality, which is also a very important part of this.
Along that line, of course, Congressman Cooper has his own bill that is drawing a lot of bipartisan support. Do you see Congressman Cooper as something of a renegade on health care, and why didn't you mention him as an enemy of the President's plan for guaranteed coverage?
Well, I think Jim Cooper has made a very important and valuable contribution to this discussion. He has put in front of us a bill that has many similarities to the Clinton plan. I know that the press and the media today is writing a lot of stories and showing a lot of stories about the differences between the plans, but I think a mistake is being made because no one's looking at the similarities. The so-called health alliances, which are controversial in the Clinton plan, are Jim Cooper's idea. That came out of his original proposal. Now, there are some important differences, and they have to be bridged. Jim Cooper's plan does not provide for universal coverage. And as I said over and over in my speech, and as the President said over and over, that's an essential. We got to figure out how to do that. But I think Jim Cooper is willing to help us figure out how to do that. His plan calls for increasing taxes on ordinary American families. I don't believe myself that that's a positive way to go, but at least he's had the courage to put in his plan, ways to pay for it, as has the Clinton plan. So there are a lot of similarities. We need to build on those. We need to work with those. And we need to try to move this thing in a very positive direction. I think we can, working together with Congressman Cooper, others who have endorsed his bill, and Republicans who have endorsed bills of their own that have similarities as well.
This questioner asks, won't it be hard to defend the Clinton bill when Clinton himself is signaling places where he would compromise?
You know, I think to answer that question, it's important that we step back for a moment and look at what's happened over the last year. President Clinton came to office saying we need health care reform and that he was going to bring a serious proposal to do that. And when he first talked to us, we said, Mr. President, it is important because this is so hard to do and it is controversial that you need to bring not just a list of specifications, which presidents normally do. You need to give us a specific bill with all of its detail worked out so that there's a very definite roadmap out there that we can follow in putting this together. And we said, by doing that, you will be forced, Hillary Clinton and all the others on the task force will be forced, as we will be forced, to think carefully about all kinds of complicated things that happen out there in the real world that we need to think about as we write a piece of legislation. And to their great credit, they did that. It took a year. It took longer than anybody thought. But to their great credit, they did it. Now, to think that you're going to take an over 1,000-page bill and say to someone, the only way to do this is to pass every word that's on those 1,000 pages is just lunacy. Of course there are going to be hundreds of places where you can compromise and change and vary the approach that is embodied in that bill. And that's why the president rightly says to people, there's room for consensus and compromise in this area or in that area or the other area. Clearly there is. And the truth is, none of us knows exactly how to do all, although we have some good real-life examples in front of us, like Hawaii, which has essentially done all of this already, and it works. So he's right to say he'll compromise. There will be change. There will be compromise. There should be. But it's also important to note that in his State of the Union speech last week, he was very clear that certain principles had to be embodied in the final bill or he would not agree to sign the bill. You know, we got to get that signature on the bill. It's worth 2/3 of us in the House and in the Senate. It's a very important piece of ink in this whole process. And he said, I will not sign a bill that does not get us to having every American be covered by health insurance. I totally agree with him for all the reasons I said in the speech. So while he's calling for compromise, he is also being vivid and clear about the principles that have to be fulfilled in the final product.
Now, Democrats now are saying that before the presidential election, Senator Lloyd Benson presented a health care bill that the Republicans would have agreed to, but the Democrats' leadership pushed it aside because they wanted to make sure this was an issue in the 92 election. How do you answer that kind of?
Well, Senator Benson and others have made many valuable suggestions for improvements in the health care system. He had a bill that performed a lot of the insurance reform that is also part of the Clinton plan that we obviously has to be done with any plan that you do. And a lot of valuable work was done by Senator Benson and others in that area. There are other areas of the bill that other members of Congress, some of which are with us here today, have done a lot of work in to get us to the point where we are today. But what I think the Clintons have brought to this, what the administration has brought this to this discussion, is that while some of these alone can be argued for and make sense in isolation, that this is a problem that demands a comprehensive solution. We can't just reach in and do insurance reform and say, there, it's okay now, we fixed it, it's all fine now. That won't work. We need to do a lot of things together. Comprehensive care, a package of comprehensive care so that we all know that we've got a reasonable package of care. Universal coverage, everybody in the plan, everybody access, everybody covered. Real competition and real cost containment so that we know that the costs are not going to spiral out of control, and so on and so forth. Insurance reform, which was Senator Benson's bill, is a very important part of that because the system we've had has allowed insurance companies to come in and cherry pick. You know, if you're an insurance writer on health, you want all 21-year-olds who have great health. That's your dream. And then charge them, you know, what you'd charge anybody else, and you make a lot of money. We can't let that go on anymore. We can't let the insurance companies pick and choose and say, we like you over there, you're healthy, we want you, and we'd like this one over here. You sick people, you go somewhere else. Can't do that. Everybody's in the pool. Everybody pays. Everybody gets when you need it. Frankly, I'd rather pay and never use it. That's what I'd like to do. But that's health insurance, and that's the value that we've got to get back to. And that's why the Benson insurance reform is so important as a part of this overall picture.
This questioner wants to know, what do you consider negotiable in Clinton's bill? Employer mandates, premium caps, or mandatory large alliances?
I think there are a number of areas where we can come up with variants on a theme. We can do this in a little bit different ways and still fulfill the goal. Let me go back to goals. We want to make sure everybody is covered. Do they have to be covered the day the bill is signed? Probably not. We can probably go through a transition period where we pick people up in some incremental fashion. Then you get to the question of, well, how long will the transition period be? And we can get into all kinds of arguments about that. And I can't answer all those questions today, but obviously you can have some variance. But what you can't do is come up with a plan that doesn't get there. Can't do that. Controlling costs. Well, there's a raging debate, always has been. Can you have competition to do that, or should we have price controls to do that? That debate's been raging since 78. That was the debate back in 78. I'm a believer you need to do both. I believe in competition. But I'm also a little skeptical of the ability of competition to finally get the job done. Now, they tell me in Hawaii it's working. And I hope it will work all over the country, and I think it can. If you get everybody on a level playing field and everybody in the pool, I think competition can really do a job. But we need some pressure on it. And so the idea of the insurance cap is attractive to me. Now, maybe it doesn't have to be on the first day again. Maybe I often use the analogy of you pull a hammer back and you pull it up here, maybe way back here, maybe all the way down to the floor, but at some point it comes around and comes down. And to me, caps of some kind, price controls of some kind, perform that service. So I see competition and controls, if you will, coexisting, but we can argue about that, don't you see? And then alliances, cooperatives or groups of people. In the Clinton plan, if you work for an employer who employs 5,000 people or more, you don't need to be in an alliance. You can go off and be your own bargainer for health care. But if you're under 5,000, then you've got to go through this alliance. It's really just a cooperative, and we've had them forever, and they work, where everybody can go to get health care. Now, you need some alliance. You got to have an alliance, because what about the small business person? They need to get in a group that's as big as General Motors. They got a bargain. We need to give them that ability. One of their problems today is they're out there, you know, a firm of three people is competing for health care along with General Motors. Pretty tough. So we need to give them that bargaining power. But where is it? Is it 100? Is it 1,000? Is it 2,500? Is it 5,000? We're going to have a discussion about that. So there's room on that one and other issues as well. You can begin to get a flavor of the discussion that's going on and has been going on, frankly, in the Congress for 2 years now about health care. And I believe we can come up with a consensus that the vast majority can vote for and get behind and importantly, move our country in a positive direction.
Two procedural questions. One says there's very little time left for Congress to complete a reform bill this year. What timetable do you envision for getting bills out of committees to conference and to the floor? And along that line, why have you not formed a super committee to bridge the gaps among the three House committees? Might you still do this to craft a bill for the floor?
Well, first of all, there's no magic about the timetable. If you, all of you, many of you know a lot about Congress and you know a lot about the way the year works. You kind of have to start at where the year is going to end. The year is going to end for Congress sometime around the 1st to the 10th, 15th of October. We're going to leave then and go home and try to get reelected, some of us. So we know that's the end point. So if we know that's the end point, we can start backing up to today. And we know kind of when things have to happen if we're going to hit that goal. Now, I believe optimally we'd like to get this done and on the president's desk before we leave for the district work period in August, which is about August the 14th. So if that's your goal, then you know, again, where you got to back up. And it means we probably need to be on the floor of the House, out of committee and on the floor of the House, sometime in the late spring, early summer. And in the Senate about the same time, so that you could get to a conference and then get to the president's desk by the 15th of August. So that one's fairly straightforward. Obviously, if it slips, then you're out in September and you're working then. As to committees, and I'm glad this question was asked, we don't need a super committee. We have four or five super committees that are really very good and know this subject backwards and forward. They have been dealing with it for a long time. We also have some super chairmen and subcommittee chairmen. And when people say to me today, they say, how are you going to get this done? It's impossible. It can't be done. I give two answers. I say, I think it is going to get done. First, because the American people want it to be done. And the American people are the major determinant of what the Congress does. Members respond to people. And people, believe me, are saying to their members today, get this done. The second reason I'm confident is because we have chair people like Henry Waxman, Pete Stark, Bill Ford, Dan Rostenkowski, John Dingell, and others who really want to get this done and have the ability, the knowledge, and the experience to get it done. And I've seen these people a long time. I've worked with them on a daily basis. I have never seen them as motivated as they are about this. And that gives me the greatest confidence that it's going to happen. I would hate to get in the way of Henry Waxman and Dan Rostenkowski and John Dingell and Bill Ford and Pete Stark when they really want to get something done. And believe me, folks, they want to get this done. And they're going to do it.
Now, there are a lot more health questions here, but you do have a small constituency who's more interested in trade, or at least is interested in trade, so I want to ask you at least one trade question before we finish up here. Are you happy with the trade negotiations currently going on between the United States and Japan in light of next week's summit meeting between the Japanese Prime Minister and Mr. Clinton?
Well, just briefly, I think the Clinton administration has brought us a much better trade policy than we have operated on in the past. In the past, we have had press releases with the Japanese, for instance, where we both say good things about what we hope happens, and then literally nothing happened. And that's been going on for 30 years. The Clinton administration has finally said, we can't just take a lot of talk. We got to do something. And so they have gone to the Japanese, great respect, and said there has to be real change. And to get real change, we think there needs to be a goal or a target in different sectors. And for instance, in semiconductors, we believe, knowing our people, knowing your people, knowing our businesses and your businesses, that if we were on a level playing field, we ought to be at about 20% of your market. That's a reasonable goal to shoot for if we were on a compatible level playing field. And if we could get the Japanese to agree to goals in different areas, then we could begin to get progress, as we have in semiconductors. That's the one area where we set a goal with the Japanese, and we've reached the goal. Because the goal creates pressure for change in Japan. The truth is, we do not have the quality of access to their market that they have had to ours. It's not evil, it's not even sometimes conscious, but it's there. The goal in trade is always to make it as free and as fair and open, easy and accessible as it is between the states of the United States. Easy said, hard to do. And that's what we're trying to do with Japan, and I believe the framework negotiation is the right way to go. I don't know if it will yield results. I hope it does. We have been supporting our negotiators. If it does not, we are prepared in the Congress to begin writing legislation that could unilaterally try to implement the kind of goal-driven strategy that the Clinton administration is negotiating with the Japanese about. And we are prepared to try to go forward with that if the negotiation fails, which I hope it does not.
Well, we are out of time. I'd like to first remind everybody that transcripts, audio and videotapes are available by calling 1-800-500-9911. Operators are standing by. And I would like to present our speaker. This is embarrassing. We are out of National Press Club mugs. What we have here is a National Press Club athletic shirt for, and it is the extra large size.
Preventive health care.
Preventive health care. It is extra large. You can go and exchange it for whatever size you like.
That's fine.
Your way out. And somewhere in here is a certificate of appreciation for appearing here.
Great.
Thank you very much, and that concludes our program. Thank you very much. That was great. That was wonderful.
Listening to the Internet Town Hall, a production of the Internet Multicasting Service in association with the National Press Club. You may copy this file and change the encoding format, but may not resell the contents or make a derivative work. Support for the Internet Town Hall comes from Sun Microsystems and O'Reilly & Associates. Additional support is provided by HarperCollins and Persoft. Network connectivity is provided by UUNET Technologies and MFS DataNet. This is Carl Malamud for the Internet Multicasting Service, Town Crier to the Global Village.